you know, it is very difficult to imagine a boat which can carry a cow from Anatolia to these islands. All these creates a very fascinating picture.
Hello and welcome to the Dive and Dig podcast. We're taking you on an underwater journey right across the ancient world from the Stone Age to the end of the Roman Empire. I'm Bethany Hughes.
And I'm Lucy Blue. And this week we're going 8,000 years into the past to the Neolithic in the Aegean world. And we're going to discover how seafaring really connected people and how advanced and connected the Neolithic world was.
I mean, I think, Lucy, you and I are pretty passionate about basically about anything that lies in the past, yeah. Particularly that lies on the seabed from the past. But I mean, 8,000 years ago, that is a seriously long time ago. And when you say the Stone Age, people still think of cave stone, women exactly. And men, and as if, you know, people were just eking out this life. Yeah. But you know, there are extraordinary discoveries to be had.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think this is it's so remarkable. I couldn't agree more, because the key to this, I think, is actually, and I know I'm slightly biased, but the sea. Because we're looking at landscapes that were very disconnected, sea levels that were potentially a hell of a lot lower. So we need, and lots of islands. So the sea was really critical to connecting people. And what we're beginning to discover, and hopefully through this journey which we're taking, we'll see how advanced and connected those landscapes really were.
Oh, I know. I mean, it is such a treat, and it's been brilliant to chat to an archaeologist about incredible discoveries that are taking us right the way back to prehistory. And these discoveries are on Ios Petros. That's an island in the northern Sporades in northern Greece, where a team are working on a dig site that's partially submerged in the sea. And I had a chat with the director of the dig just as he was embarking on his latest season.
The Aegean Sea is rich and full of extraordinary finds, but there's a particular dig ongoing, which is quite remarkable. Nikos Eftrastiou from the Aristotle University of Thessaloniki is in charge of this. And I know that, you know, there's a lot to be discovered there, but can you just talk to us about it? Because my understanding is that what you've discovered is 8,000 years old. So we're talking way back in the Neolithic. It's the earliest dated submerged site discovered so far in the Aegean. So just so that people get their heads around this is, you know, way older than Homer and the composition of the Iliad and the Odyssey, way older than the Great Pyramids. We're going back, you know, way beyond that. So tell me about it, Nikos.
This is an extraordinary site. It's because it's the only site we have from so early back, about 8,000 years ago, which is a representative picture of an early farming village in Greece.
It's remarkable that it's a whole village. You know, we're used to finding finds that have been damaged in some way or kind of unique finds. But a whole village from the Neolithic period is incredible. So what evidence are you finding within that village for everyday life?
The way we detect, we find these sites is by walking on that spot. And then we discover clay, pottery. We discover other evidence of human presence, like obsidian, which is a glass material, which comes from the island of Milos. So when the site was found, it was very easy for us to realize that these people came from somewhere else, or they had they were in touch with other people in the southern Aegean. And also we were able to detect remains of their everyday life, like bones, animal bones, and also human burials. We managed to detect these human burials, at least two burials, which were found at the site.
so many things that you're describing that that have been found. So pottery, tools, bone remains. They're brilliant windows into the everyday lives of people from the early Neolithic. And I think I'm right in saying that you've discovered evidence of tuna fishing. And if that's the case, tuna fishing requires a very particular set of skills. So we should really be thinking about these people as remarkably sophisticated, given how long ago they were making a life for themselves in this island.
We know from the bones we have collected that some of these fish were tuna fish, and we know very well that tuna you can fish tuna in deep waters. So you cannot catch a tuna around the island. You have to use some kind of boat and be able to travel, because you need tuna fish is found in deep waters. So in that sense, we know from what we call indirect evidence that these people were fishing in deep waters. Of course, we do have fish bones which belong to smaller fish. So in that sense, they were quite capable of fishing both in deep waters and also from the shore. And that gives an idea of their everyday life. And also, we know again from the bones, from the animal bones we found in the island, that they were pastoralists. They were keeping domesticated animals like cows and pigs, sheep and goats. Well, it is very difficult to imagine a boat which can carry a cow from Anatolia to these islands. So all these creates a very fascinating, I think, picture. And also it leaves open many, many questions about these early seafaring practices.
I just think it's great, isn't it, Bethany, this idea of a about 8,000 years ago that's carrying a cow across the water. It's something that is a bit of a dilemma because people reach these islands, but we really don't have a sense of the mechanics of that, in effect.
Yeah, I mean, and just as you say, the picture that conjures up, yeah, I mean, I know cows can be quite docile, but they're not always. And kind of how you keep them calm on a boat crossing from Anatolia, so that's, you know, largely what's modern day Turkey now, kind of out to these Greek islands. I mean, it's just remarkable. And what Nikos talks about, the problem of evidence, but there is some evidence, isn't there, for what these Stone Age boats might have been like?
No, absolutely. I mean, there's, largely we're not finding full scale boats, but effectively we've got, you know, quite a few models of smaller boat models, and also images of boats, whether it's on rock art or other forms of iconography. But essentially what we're looking at is something that is based around a log. So a hollowed out log. We don't really know. In some cases, they've probably not even been expanded. So this is quite a basic vessel, usually paddled, but increasingly we have evidence for sail. So
can I just chip in? So just one thing you're saying about the models. So what do you mean? How have models survived from 8,000 years ago?
Well, because a lot of them are clay. So in the same way that, you get clay ceramics, some of them being introduced in this period, as we know, you're also getting clay boats. So, yeah, Bethany, I'm no expert in Neolithic boats, but I have a student, Panos Savaras, who's incredible. He knows what he doesn't know about Neolithic log boats. It doesn't exist. So I went and had a chat with him just to really answer your question, what does these models look like? Panos, thank you very much for agreeing to contribute to this podcast. We've already had a really interesting discussion with Nikos, who's the director of the Agios Petros site, which I know you're aware of. And I think what's really fascinating about this period in archaeological history is just the sheer scale of connectivity. You know, we're talking about 8,000 years ago, and I think it's very hard sometimes for people to comprehend that you know, human beings were travelling on the water, they were moving around, and they weren't just doing it for little fishing activities. They were having quite, you know, targeted seafaring. So, and I know you've been studying the boats for a very long time. and your knowledge of boats, I think, surpasses everybody and anybody. You have found every scrap of evidence there is for Neolithic seafaring in the Aegean. So maybe you could just tell me a little bit about the sort of material you're uncovering that relates to us understanding the nature of boats in this period.
The number that I have come across, it reaches more than 250 boat images, and I'm talking about iconography and figurines.
Wow, that's a lot, isn't it? So, okay, you've collated all this information, and let's focus on the models. If you think of a model 30, 40 centimetres, what sort of information can you extract from that, considering it probably wasn't built to float? I had some friends staying over the weekend and their small child was putting all my boat models in the pond, and many of them just went straight to the bottom. So if you're trying to work out, you know, what the capabilities of these boats are, what information can you extract from them?
Yeah, that's a really nice question, and it is very tricky because there are a lot of people that are doing the mistake of taking these boat representations as an actual functional boat. Most of the models are built with a flat bottom just in order to be able to stand upright. So we have to be really cautious on what we are extracting from them. So we are picking the most obvious stuff, like the general shape of the hull, and mostly how the two posts are developed, and things like internal framework, if there is any, and things that help the stability of the boat, like keel.
And obviously the connection between the keel and the sail are quite important as well.
So in terms of the sail, we have the first evidence of its use in the late Neolithic period, around 4500 BC, as it has been attested in the rock art from the fortified settlement of Strophilas on Andros.
So what does that all mean? I mean, okay, we've got some boats with possible evidence for keel, we've got pretty early evidence for sail, but what does that mean? What does that mean that these people can do? Where were they sailing? Why were they sailing?
It confirms what we did know before the scholars' interest in boats, based on the pottery, which is one of the hard data of archaeology, that there is a big dispersion of population and an extreme interconnectivity, as well as a general system of codes and symbols. We can term it as a pan-Aegean system of codes and symbols that has been implemented in the whole Aegean and the mainland, and in the mainland. And it also confirms the technological capabilities of the people of this period, which initially the Neolithic period was considered as a very
like a backwater, technologically barren.
Exactly, technological barren. Yeah, that's exactly how you can name that period. But this is a general misconception that has been shifted not only by the advent of boat building that can be traced far beyond the Neolithic, but also because during the late Neolithic we also have other phenomena like metallurgy, which also helped the capabilities of building better boats.
I mean, I think that's really the underlying bit of information, that people were moving around way, way earlier than we ever could have dreamed of. Yes. And okay, the million-dollar question, which I should know the answer to, but have we actually found a full-size Neolithic boat?
No, we did not. The only evidence we have are from mainland Greece. The one stems from a lake settlement site from Castoria, which are boat imprints, and that's the middle to late Neolithic. The other one is also from the mainland Greece, and more specifically northern Greece, from the Amidio Basin, which is also a lake settlement. And there the excavators have announced that they have found parts of a logboat.
I mean, it's just such an exciting area of research, because every day it's like you're pushing the boundaries even earlier and earlier. What I mean, I know you're incredibly rigorous about the way you approach this, but what would you say is like the most exciting thing that you've discovered?
The multitude of rock art engraving, engravings that have been found in the settlement of Strophilas on Andros. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of rock art depictions and around 150 boat representations, which is amazing. That, of course, does not mean that this settlement had a navy or consisted of like 100 boats, but it's like modern art. They were trying to represent something that allows them to traverse the unknown, which is the sea, which is that's why it is most usually accompanied by apotropaic symbols like phalluses or other stuff.
I just love the way that Panos, you know, he's so into thinking about what the boat looks like and measuring things and making sure, collecting, that he's got all the data. But then he opens up with this whole connection in terms of the way that the symbolism of the boats and the sort of religious nature, particularly at these sites in the Cyclades, it's just really fascinating. And again, it just gives you that insight into the sophistication, in a way, of Neolithic cultures.
And also a bit of an insight into their worldview and into their mindset. Because as you say, I mean, this is a world, I think we just have to kind of head shift for a moment and think that this is an animist world. It's a world of spirits where there are, and there aren't even gods and goddesses at this time. They're just spirits everywhere in everything, you know, in every wave, in every breath of wind, and every, you know, fruit that ripens on the tree. And I agree, first of all, what a great man I want to meet Panos, but also the fact that, as you say, he had these, the models had flat bottoms so that they could be stood up. So that suggests that they're being, whatever, placed in homes or sort of on little shrines so that people can presumably beg for a safe crossing over the sea or worship some kind of sea spirit or something. So it's a much more, yeah, it's not just technology, you know, that's interesting, but there's something else very spiritual going on there too.
No, absolutely. I think that really, it really connects them with the sort of everyday lives of people in a way, the fact that they're not, you know, that they have these flat bottoms and all the rest of it, as you say. So, I'm just so excited by Panos's work, because I think that every day he's finding new material. And of course, this reflects back to to what's happening at Agios Petros. Obviously, a lot of the material he's finding is considerably later. It's not 8,000 years ago. But all the same, it's starting to give us this understanding of that change, I guess.
Yeah. So, and just, he said he's found 250 boat images so far. Is that just in the Aegean then?
That's kind of his field. And in fact, I think the numbers, those are relating to the sort of standalone ones. But some of these sites in the Cyclades, he's got hundreds, literally, of rock art engravings of boats, some of them actually leading up in a slightly processional way to the sort of central religious part of the site. So again, it talks about the symbolic nature of these boats.
That's so cool. And as you said, you know, so there's that Neolithic period, and then some of those finds are also telling us about the sort of sophistication as you go a bit later in time. So obsidian, he talks about. Oh, I'm obsessed with obsidian. I just love it. Is that volcanic glass?
No, it's so beautiful. Although I've discovered bits of obsidian before, I'm definitely not the world expert, but I think we should now go and have a chat with my very good friend and colleague, Dr. Helen Farr from the University of Southampton, because she knows more about obsidian and the Neolithic world, and particularly in relation to seafaring, than anybody else I know.
The Neolithic breaks down as Neolithic, New Stone Age, and the different types of lithic associated with that. So for the Neolithic, one of those things are ground stone axes, which are thought to be used for maybe land clearance. But another thing we see very often, especially in the Mediterranean region, are these exotic lithics, and obsidian is a good example of this. So obsidian itself is a volcanic glass. It's very black and shiny. It forms when a particular type of lava, rhyolitic lava, comes out of an eruption from a volcanic source, and it's super cooled, so it's quenched. And as it cools so fast, a crystalline structure isn't able to form, and you get this very glassy quality to the stone. Now, if you think about how stone tools are napped, because this is a chipstone technology, as you hit the glass, this big nodule of glass. Imagine you're holding it in your hand, a grapefruit-sized piece of obsidian, and you're napping it. The energy from your hammerstone or your percussion instrument goes through in waves and ripples out, and you can basically reduce the stone core by removing these lovely flakes.
I love your description of how the obsidian is napped or formed, and it's something that is found all over the Aegean and beyond. I know your work has taken you down to Italy.
You see that obsidian being transported 1,000 kilometres, but it's a very Neolithic thing. And it seems to be a very Mediterranean maritime movement thing that we're seeing. And the interesting side to come out to my research is that we saw that people were taking to the sea in the Mesolithic. So the period before in the Holocene, people are going out, they're having sort of strategies, hunting and gathering strategies, where they go out and they visit islands. But by the fifth millennium, really, by the time we see the Neolithic across that Mediterranean region, all the way across, all the islands are occupied or regularly visited, and raw materials are being used. We see a very different sort of strategy happening. So we see an increase in seafaring. We see a very different scale to seafaring in the Neolithic from what we saw before. But the links, the roots, are often there much, much earlier. So it's really interesting. There are echoes to some of the things that we see from the Mesolithic and the early Neolithic. But by the end of the Neolithic, by the final Neolithic, it's just exploded. It's the scale of travel and the scale of things that are being transported, which is significantly different. And that's what we're seeing in the Neolithic. We're seeing a very new way of using boats, not just to get from A to B, to actually cross a body of water occasionally, or to hunt, or to fish, but we're seeing it as a trade system and a trade network which just carries on developing and developing as people want to acquire more and more. And alongside the acquisition of more stuff, of course, is the acquisition of more knowledge, more skill, and more technology. So it's constantly building and building and building. I think that seafaring really was the glue that allowed this Mediterranean maritime sort of colonization of the Neolithic, almost spreading through from east to west. It seems to be on a Mediterranean, central Mediterranean latitude anyway, and we see connectivity. And I think that's where we see the importance of the seafaring. So possibly that connection is about gaining some sort of status, gaining very valued materials, but also creating contacts and links.
I love the fact that she's almost as obsessed with obsidian, possibly more than you and I are. And just for anybody who's listening who hasn't had the joy of holding obsidian in their hand, it's very beautiful because it's this sort of black volcanic glass. So it's really shiny, as Helen says, really, really sharp. And I have an archaeologist friend who shall remain nameless, who worked on Neolithic sites with obsidian and then went in for a very, very, very serious operation and insisted on having an obsidian blade be used to cut him open, because he said this is the finest, you know, it's not going to break like steel blades can break. And it happened, you know, and he lived to tell the tale. So it worked, obsidian. So I can see what they got in those boats.
Absolutely. And they travelled massive distances, actually, because I mean, Milos, the main source, is quite considerably further south than Agios Petra. But it also makes, I'm thinking back a bit about some of the things that Nikos was saying about this connection, as you said, with Anatolia, with the Turkish mainland. And, you know, how that, a lot of the evidence, particularly some of the stuff that Panos is coming up with as well, seems to be connecting this movement from the north, from the northeast in a way, across the north of the Aegean, particularly in these earlier periods, which I think is quite fascinating. And it makes you think about, well, why, what are the drivers, that sort of thing.
Well, definitely. And that's, as you say, it's so fascinating because we know the drivers aren't always necessity, that actually people have got enough food, they've got enough people to make love to kind of create the next generation of the community. But it's that curiosity. Mm. It's the kind of what does lie over the horizon. Mm. And I know it's going to be perilous and I know we might die in the attempt, but hell, let's just get in a log boat and go and see what's there. So it really, I find it very inspiring, a kind of very inspiring indication of the bravery and bravura, in a way, of and brio of the human species.
Yeah, the other thing that Helen was talking about was this idea of acquiring status as well, which I think, you know, so as you say, it's not just treacherous, but it's also really trying to acquire something for myself to give me a position in society. And it's those small little things like the obsidian that provide that access, I guess, to societal, unfortunately, layers that we don't necessarily would want to encourage. But
no, well, I think, I mean, again, that's right, that's what's so interesting, isn't it, about society, you know, that we talk about equity and equality, and basically as soon as we can we try to do things that make us unequal to the people around us. But it also just that drive to travel, you know, to learn new things, to meet new people, to acquire new ideas. It's very much a hallmark of our species, isn't it? So, you know, for good and for bad. But it's what made civilization itself happen. There's no doubt about that. And none of that could have happened without the ability to cross the seas, even in those very early boats.
Thank you for reinforcing that, Bethany.
But
thank you.
Total pleasure. Heartfelt. And actually, I know, just going back to the team on Ios Petros, I think they're going to be doing some DNA work in the future, aren't they?
I think that's the plan for this coming season. So we might get a bit more insight into, you know, the nature of the people that live there, which would be really exciting. But also, it would be really interesting, because they're doing coring, to really try and nail that understanding of where the sea level was and how it changed over time. Because it was obviously driven by the melting ice caps after the last ice age. But we don't really know how it impacted. And clearly, obviously, the Aegean, particularly in that area, is very tectonically active. So this could be another factor in that changing sea levels. And it could be quite dramatic. And in which case, if it's dramatic, then we could have this site buried quite quickly, which then goes back to this whole idea of, you know, submerged landscapes, preserving organics, all those exciting things that can give us a much more in-depth sort of idea of what happened in the Neolithic, all those things that we never find on land.
Yeah, so thrilling. It's so thrilling. And it's what makes archaeology so exciting. So I think people have this notion, and sort of somehow, that the past is somewhere static that you visit and then you interrogate it. But it's always changing. It's really protean. The technology that we have to explore it is always changing as well. So, you know, and never say never in archaeology or history. You have no idea what new gem is going to emerge. You know, literally a physical gem or a gem of understanding. So, you know, and thank goodness for Lucy, can I just say it? Thank goodness for maritime and marine archaeologists like you, who helps actually physically get down there to discover that evidence.
Oh, it's a hard life. It's a hard life.
Hard luck. But thank you. A life that you've, you know, devoted your waking hours to. And a lot more to discover, including on these podcasts. So you please, listeners, join us again on Dive and Dig. This is a podcast made by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports maritime archaeological research across the Eastern Mediterranean. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you.